Mid-mornings with Lee Chambers.
In front of me, I've got Amanda Ryder, nutritional therapist. We're going to be talking about detoxing, hence the pure part of pure and simple. Amanda, hello.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Fine, very well. Just remind us what a nutritional therapist does.
Okay, well, in a sentence, I suppose I help people optimise their health by choosing the right foods and adopting the right lifestyle.
Yeah. Okay, great. And we're talking about detoxing today. So what is detoxing? How would you describe it?
I would describe it as improving the body's own natural processes of improving your detoxification, if you like, rather than going on a specific detoxification diet. So improving, I mean, we are designed to detox all the time. So I would encourage people to optimise their detoxification capabilities, if you like.
But would a special diet do that? So the body can detox itself and a special diet would just help it
do that? So, I mean, the body's, you know, has a natural process of removing toxins and we're doing that all day long. Would a detox diet help? I mean, there are so many detox diets out there and people love them. They love going on a detox. But I think the reality is the reason that they feel better at the end of it is that they've lost weight. You know, they've probably avoided some stimulants, fats, etc. But I think they can be too severe sometimes.
Yes, because the most famous ones are the ones where you're living on a lemon a day or something.
Yes, exactly. Or all fruit and veg. So you can lose a lot of muscle mass if you do that. You can feel dizzy. You know, it can be dangerous for certain individuals with health issues. So like I said, I think it's more important to actually optimise your body's detoxification processes more naturally and in a slightly calmer way rather than, you know, 5 days of very restricted calories.
So how would we do that? How would we help the body detox itself?
Well, you know, it's all about balance. So, I mean, just to think, you know, at the simplest level, a toxin is something capable of causing disease or damaging tissue when it enters the body. And when most people hear the word toxin, they think of chemicals like pesticides, heavy metals or industrial pollutants. But actually, you know, even beneficial nutrients like water, which are absolutely necessary to sustain life, can be toxic at high doses. So I think a detox diet, you've got to look at what your toxins are. So, you know, if you're somebody who smokes, you're going to be exposing yourself to, you know, obviously a lot of cadmium. I think there's 1 to 2 micrograms of cadmium in every cigarette. That's a heavy metal, tends to accumulate in the body. Or if you're drinking a lot of alcohol, you know, even stress can be quite toxic. If you're eating a lot of processed foods, you know, you're exposing your body to preservatives and those kind of chemicals. If you're eating, you know, fruit and vegetables that aren't organic, you've got pesticides that you are being exposed to. And then even things like cured meats, they contain nitrites and nitrates, which the studies are sort of, you know, not quite sure if they're carcinogenic, meaning they're harmful to human tissue or not. But, you know, I would suggest that people don't have too much of that kind of stuff. Keep it to 2 or 3 times a week with the evidence that we do have. So to detoxify, so that you need to look at what your toxifiers are, if you like. And then I think the best way is to say, okay, I'm going to have a really clean diet. And this is what I do with my clients. So for maybe a 5-day period, I would ask them to eat, clean diet. So avoid the processed foods.
By processed foods, you're meaning things that,
processed foods, things that you buy off the shelf, like biscuits, wheat, you know, bread rather, not wheat, but cakes, you know, nice ready-made meals, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's the nice things. I know they're not good for you, but yeah.
Well, I don't know. You know, it depends. You know, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because biscuits and sweet things, we all like that kind of stuff. But the reality is, when you eat a lot of it, you do get quite addicted to it. And now, for me, now obviously I'm highly motivated, but for me, the idea of eating, you know, 6 or 8 very sweet cookies from, you know, a supermarket, oh my God, how horrible. Honestly, it would make me feel so horrible that I have that association with it. So I think detox diets are good. You know, a clean diet, I would say, foods made from scratch. I quite like people to, if they're trying to have a sort of gentle cleanse, focus on, you know, proteins with vegetables, steamed vegetables, and doing that 3 times a day without actually really restricting calories, but just cutting out all the rubbish, really. And I suppose I might suggest somebody do that if they have what I call the FLC syndrome, you know, feel like crap all the time, which a lot of people do. They feel really tired and lethargic and their joints are aching. And of course, it's not always because they've got a toxic overload, but sometimes a nice clean diet for 4 or 5 days can be quite helpful. And also, I think when people do that, they tend to experience what it's like to eat real foods that haven't been processed and haven't got lots of salt and sugar and fat and, you know, chemicals in them. And they're actually tasting real foods. And it's a good stepping stone from perhaps a diet of eating, you know, a lot of processed food to a diet whereby, you know, 80% of the time you're eating cleaner foods that are going to nourish you and make you feel better.
So you're cutting out the processed foods, you're cutting out things with sugar, things with salt, and you're saying...
No. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with salt per se. It's when you have too much of it. And
right.
Again, it's always about balance. But I would say if somebody wanted to do a gentle cleanse... focusing on the protein and the vegetables, especially vegetables like broccoli, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, rocket, the cruciferous vegetables. We know, and studies have confirmed this, that they contain two compounds called sulforaphane and indole-3-carbinol, and they have been shown to improve the detoxifying capacities of the liver. So that's really good, you know, those dark green leafy vegetables. You know, and avoiding stimulants like caffeine, also stuff, you know, obvious stuff like getting lots of fresh air and being calmer. Garlic, onions, they're quite good. They contain sulfur, and that can also help support our own internal detoxification processes. One of our master antioxidants is called glutathione, and they sulfur compounds in foods can help support the production of glutathione.
So if you're saying eating more fruit and vegetables, which makes sense,
yeah,
with the protein, what protein would you recommend?
I would recommend free range, you know, free range poultry. I would also recommend free range meats. I quite like venison if you're into red meat. You know, foods, again, that haven't been highly manipulated. You know, sometimes I think very intensely farmed meat can contain antibiotics, steroids. So trying to buy your, you know, meat and poultry locally, going to farmers market, that kind of thing. It doesn't always have to be expensive, but perhaps it does take a bit more effort. I appreciate that.
And if you didn't want meat, if you wanted fish or something vegetarian, what would that be?
Yeah, so fish, you know, white fish. Oily fish is fine a couple of times a week. I mean, if you eat a lot of oily fish, you know, especially the larger fish like tuna, they can contain a lot of mercury. They're large fish, so they're predator fish, so they're eating all the small fish, you know, so they bioaccumulate, you know, a lot of mercury. So if you're having something like tuna, I would suggest you only have it a couple of times a week.
And what would the vegetarian option would be? Something like pulses, like lentils?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah, lots of soluble fibre. I mean, soluble fibre is very good because it helps, you know, remove toxins from the body. And if you think that most people think of the detoxification organs being the liver, but they're also the kidney, the lymphatic system, the bowel, the skin, it's all involved. So having regular bowel movements, you know, is a really good thing. So getting lots of soluble fibre in, so exactly, pulses are really good for that.
What about cheese? Where does that fall in this? Because that is
cheese,
a kind of processed
food. Cheese, it's a saturated fat, and I don't have anything against saturated fats per se, but I think if you're doing a five-day cleanse, I wouldn't have a high levels of saturated fat. But I would certainly say if you wanted to have cheese with one of your meals, you know, two or three of that 5 days, I would say that would be fine.
So yeah. You're talking about 5 days here as the recommended time to do this sort of...
There's no hard and fast rule out there. If you go on the internet, there are so many different detox diets. You know, some people 2 days, some people 10. But there is no evidence to support that if you do detoxification diets, that it's going to, you're going to release all those toxins in your body and get rid of them. So for me, I see it more as a sort of gentle cleansing, or just giving your body a bit of a break. Yeah.
And is it the kind of, you know, if we then detox and then go back to eating normally, do you cancel out everything that you've done in the detox, or are there some benefits that your body might still carry forward?
Yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, you know, imagine eating clean for 5 days, you're bound to feel a little bit better. And I would hope that you've, you know, changed habits slightly because you've done that. And you think, actually, I do feel quite good eating these foods. And what I usually see is 2 days, people don't feel as good. But by day three or by day four, they're certainly feeling a bit more energized. So they have that positive connotation with eating nice big salads and, you know, a portion of chicken or turkey or white fish or whatever. So I would hope that people would adapt some of those habits and continue to carry them on.
And how often should we do something like this? Because people only tend to think about it really after Christmas, where or times where they've overindulged.
Yeah, once a year. Again, no hard and fast rules. But I think, like I said at the beginning, just focus on optimizing your detoxification processes, and you can do that, by eating clean foods, including plenty of fibre in your diet, so lots of fruit and vegetables, organic if possible. There is a Dirty Dozen, and if you go on the Environmental Working Group, they look at, certain fruits and vegetables that have higher levels of pesticides. So the Dirty Dozen include apples, strawberries, grapes, celery, peaches, spinach, peppers, nectarines, cucumber, cherry tomatoes, snap peas and potatoes. So they're the 12 that you should try and get organic if you can. Exercising 2 or 3 times a week, that can be really good to aid your detoxification processes, because it improves the blood flow to the liver, which is one of the major detoxification organs, and it also helps you to sweat. So, the skin is also another detox organ, so you're sweating out the toxins. And also, I've been reading quite a lot about saunas. Having a sauna a couple of times a week can be really good for detoxing. It kind of, acts as the deeper levels of the skin, so you sort of sweat it out. Having adequate water. By that, I mean sort of 1.5 to 2 litres a day, generally in between meals rather than with meals.
That's a lot of water, isn't it? I mean,
it is quite a lot of
people struggle to drink that much.
Yeah, I think I think a really good habit to get into is to have a glass of water on getting up. As soon as you get out of bed, one glass of water. You get into that habit, and then you look for that glass of water, and you're already off to a really good start. And then if you have 4 or 5 big glasses throughout the day, you've done it.
I always know that I should drink more water, but it's just so boring. Is there any way of making it more interesting?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I like to put cucumber in, ginger, apple, orange, lime, lemon. Just make a big jug in the morning, stick it on the table or wherever you're going to have access to it, put a few glasses around, and my family will always come and help themselves to water. Just make it more attractive.
So you just would cut up cucumber
I'd
and
cut
apple
up cucumber.
And just put it in the
sometimes
bottom.
I put mint in. Lime is lovely, a few slices of lime. Yeah, I know what you mean. Make it more exciting.
Without
and you
making
do
it
actually
unhealthy.
Find the more water you drink, and I think... you have probably experienced this. The more water that you drink, the more you want. But when you're kind of used to not having very much. But being hydrated, is a good thing. Also, think about what you're being exposed to. Are you walking along a busy road and breathing in lots of fumes, carbon monoxide? What are you putting on your skin? I mean, a lot of substances can be absorbed through the skin. Cleaning products. I think if you're cleaning the bathroom, lots of bleach and all, some of these cleaning products can have hundreds of chemicals in them. Make sure the room's well ventilated. If you're smoking, please stop. I mean, that's so, breathing in smoke is really very toxic. So just be aware of your toxic load, as well as improving your detox, capacity.
And you're saying you've got a handout that's
I've got a lovely handout to how to optimise your liver. And it's just 10 easy ways to, aid liver function. Basically going over what I've talked about today, really.
And if people want a copy of that, or they want to find out more about your work, what should they do?
Yeah, they can go onto my website and there's a contact page, or they can go contact me through my Facebook, which is Amanda Ryder Nutrition.
And Ryder is with a Y.
With a Y. And they can send me an email to info@AmandaRyderNutrition.com.
Great.co.uk. Well, thank you very much, Amanda.
You're very welcome.
I'm feeling very guilty about my large coffee sitting next to me now.
But again, I mean, don't feel guilty about your large coffee. Having one coffee, two coffees a day, your body can cope with that. No problem.
Great. Thank you very much. You made me feel better already.
From 10 till 1. Mid-mornings with Phil Rowe. Cambridge
105. So they may not be black and white, like big giant pandas, but staff at Shepworth Wildlife Park were just as excited about the long-awaited arrival of their much smaller red panda twins. I went along and, gave them adoring glances. I'm not sure they gave me adoring glances back, but they were a sight to behold. The South Cambridgeshire Wildlife Park has wanted to home this species for over 20 years, and the dream finally became a reality after the park joined the European Association of Zoos and Aquaria. That happened just 3 years ago, allowing the collection to be included in the European Endangered Breeding Programme. Two young female red pandas, they're just under a year old, were named on Saturday afternoon after children and families were asked in a competition to name them both. Sundara was one of the winning names, and Ember was the other, after a competition was set up to dream the best names for those two adorable little red pandas. Actors Jason Merrills and Emma Lowndes opened the envelopes to reveal the names of both pandas, and they also cut the red ribbon to open the new enclosure and announce, as I say, those names too. The red pandas finally arrived 2 weeks ago after months of preparation to the new exhibit and fulfilling the necessary license requirements to make the compound or the pen up to standard. When they reach maturity, one of the females will be exchanged with a male to assist with the breeding program. I spoke to their keeper, Alex Perry, about all of this. So on a rather glorious afternoon at 1 o'clock on Saturday, we have just witnessed the opening, a celebrity opening in fact, with the red tape being cut of the new pandas enclosure. I'm actually with Alex Perry, who's head of West Section. She tells me it's rather smarter and posher sounding than it actually is down at the Shepworth Wildlife Park, just not far from Shepworth Railway Station itself and just around the corner. A nice handy number of people have come along this afternoon. I would say probably a crowd of about 100 people that have come to witness the opening. Actors Jason Merrills and Emma Lowndes have also come along to lend their hand to this as well, as we talk, the press are taking pictures of them. In front of me though is Alex. Alex, how long have you been working for Shepworth Wildlife Park, or are you indeed a volunteer?
I've been working here about 5 years, and I run West Section on the park.
Just the two of you there that run West Section?
It is. It's divided between myself and my colleague Phil Barber. So we divvy up the section between us.
And you tell me that there are other sections, including an east one and a south one, and there's no north one at the moment?
There isn't, no, but we do also have an education team, so they kind of make up the fourth section, as it were.
And there'll be an expansion as you go along, and there probably will end up being a north section. But the most important thing here today is the wonderful view of the two pandas. The white one, I think, has been trailing around at ground level. We say the white-faced one, and right on cue, she is coming over to us. So these are two young females.
They are. They're about a year old. They were born at Toro Park in France just last year. So they've come across to us so that we can get involved in the endangered species breeding programmes.
And what age will they be when they reach maturity as adults and be able to hopefully reproduce?
It'll probably be another year or so yet. And we also have to wait for a male to become available before we can think about breeding.
Two girls here we have. We want to bring in a male, I understand, later on if we can find one. But globally, their habitation is China.
Yeah, they're actually found in a number of countries in that part of the world. They're found in China, India, Bhutan, Tibet, Nepal, places like that. But numbers in the world are getting lower and lower by the day. Depending on whose estimates you're going by, there's anything between 6,000 and 14,000 left in the wild. But I think even the top end of that estimate is really quite low.
Is it a case of, once again, man predating on them?
To some degree, habitat loss is the biggest issue. There's a lot of deforestation going on, both for grazing, for farmland, but also just chopping down trees to clear for roads and kind of to get firewood and things like that. They are being predated on now more than they ever were. They were never really were an animal that were intentionally caught in the past. They were mostly caught as bycatch when people were putting down traps for things like wild pigs. Now, however, with them becoming more well known and with them becoming rarer, there's a growing demand for them in some parts of the world. It's that rather frustrating catch-22, whereby the more endangered an animal becomes, the more valuable and desirable it becomes in certain quarters.
Sadly, on some people's plates in restaurants sometimes.
Indeed. It's a fairly recent trend, but there are some restaurants in China now serving red panda meat on the menu. With any luck, it'll be a short-lived one. It'll have to be, really, for...
Is there any international pressure that can be put on politically or otherwise to maybe make Chinese society change its mind about what should be eaten?
It's a bit of a tricky issue because a lot of these countries, it is actually illegal to catch the red panda. But just because something's illegal doesn't stop people doing it. It really is a matter of trying to change attitudes and how people see these animals and seeing them less as something to be desired to have and more something to have a desire to protect.
Are there good conservation programs going on around the world? Obviously, we have our pair of girls, as we like to call them here. We're not quite sure how many there are in the UK, but elsewhere in Europe or across the world, in North America, are there programs?
There are programs going on both in North America and Europe, as well as India. I believe China are breeding them, but I don't know whether it's a coordinated kind of managed breeding program. But certainly there are very good breeding projects going across the world, both for Fulgens fulgens, which is the subspecies that we hold, and there's also a few places holding Fulgens tiani, the other subspecies.
Everybody thinks of the black and white panda. What would you call that? The common panda, even though they're not the common panda, the big panda?
That would be the giant panda, yeah.
These will grow to, what, a quarter of the third of the size of a giant panda?
They get to between around about 4 to 6 kilos, so they're significantly smaller and lighter than the giant panda. But it should be stressed, they're not related at all. These guys are actually the original pandas. The red pandas were discovered around about 50 years before the giant panda.
And much closer to another family of animals than the giant panda.
Indeed, they're actually much closer related to things like mustelids and the Procyonids, which is the raccoon family. But even with them, it is quite a distant relationship. Their nearest common ancestor was around about 38 million years ago.
Very much raccoon-sized. But diet, more that of pandas.
Yeah, well, their diet is very different from raccoons. Though their ancestors would have been more of a carnivore, the red panda is pretty much 95% of it bamboo, so it's almost all of it. So for that reason, they are really quite different in terms of their diet.
It's a busy day. I'm going to let you get on and deal with the public who are really enjoying themselves. Lovely to see so many children around here. And wonderful photographic opportunities on a sunny day like this. Alex, thanks very much for joining us today.
That was keeper Alex Perry down at Shepworth Wildlife Park on Saturday afternoon, along with the rest of the crowds of people that came along to see the new enclosures unveiled and meet Sundara and Ember, the new red panda, which are now beginning to settle themselves in. And if you want to see a picture of them and do a little bit of this morning, then go to Cambridge 105's Facebook page. We've actually put a picture of the pair of them up in the tree in the enclosure at Shepworth Wildlife Park. You want to see what I saw on Saturday.
Afternoons with Matt Webb.
So in less than 24 hours, those north of the border in Scotland will be voting whether or not to stay in the UK. Although the historic vote's been making our headlines over the last month, campaigning on both sides started nearly 2 years ago. But what impact could a potential yes vote have on us here in Cambridge? Or if Scotland chooses to stay in the UK, what effect could a no vote and extra powers for the Scottish Parliament have on our cherished city? Joining me in the studio to discuss this shortly is the Cambridge political blogger and ex-Lib Dem activist Phil Rogers. But first, this report from Tom Harrigan.
On September the 18th, we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to choose a new and better direction for Scotland.
The polls are too close to call. Each side has had the edge in the last fortnight. So what will happen if Scotland does vote yes to independence? Firstly, First Minister Alex Salmond wants to keep the pound, but the Bank of England won't let a sovereign Scotland share it.
We take note of the position of all the major Westminster parties to rule out a currency union.
Big employers like the Royal Bank of Scotland would move their headquarters to England.
The position of RBS in an independent Scotland would be very difficult.
And doing the shopping would get more expensive, according to the boss of John Lewis.
If it becomes more complex to operate across two markets, that cost will have to get reflected in prices.
Order!
But decisions on who gets to hold on to the revenue from things like North Sea oil will be made here at Westminster. Scots would still vote for MPs at next year's general election under independence, but they'd leave the Commons on the day of a breakaway, penciled in for March 2016. Labour has lots of MPs in Scotland, which is why leader Ed Miliband,
change with no or huge risks with yes,
is campaigning hard for the union, and he wouldn't be the only one under pressure.
I would be heartbroken if this family of nations was torn apart.
The Prime Minister's position would be questioned. And then there's Trident. Alex Salmond wants Britain's nuclear deterrent removed from Scotland, although it's unclear where it would be relocated. Scotland may compete separately from Team GB at international sporting events too, and the Union flag could even have to be redesigned to remove the saltire of St Andrew, but Graham Bartram from the Flag Institute is sceptical.
We wouldn't change it, we'd just carry on with the one we've got.
Even so, it's clear an independent Scotland would mean huge changes either side of the border.
So to digest this in a little more detail this afternoon, I'm joined in the studio by the Cambridge political blogger and ex-Lib Dem activist Phil Rogers. Good afternoon, Phil.
Good afternoon.
Firstly, Phil, how do you think the yes and no campaigns have been run? Obviously, in recent days, onlookers have seen a lot of tit-for-tat being thrown between two sides.
That's right. It's got very passionate as the last week has approached. I was actually in Scotland in August, and there were a few banners about, but there didn't really seem to be the sort of passion and engagement on the streets that we've seen recently. But it's set fair to be perhaps the biggest turnout election or vote that Scotland has ever seen. Back in the general election, there was about a 63% turnout, but we could see something very extraordinary tomorrow.
Do you think that the tit for tat's being thrown because it's like a general election type thing where people are sort of getting quite passionate about what's happening and some of the sides are a bit worried that they might lose?
That's right. I mean, people get passionate about a general election, but if anything, for Scotland, this is even more important than a general election. It's a one-off decision that's going to have huge repercussions for a long time to come.
And yesterday evening, TNS released the results of a poll where those of us in England and Wales had the chance to have our say on whether we wanted Scotland to stay in the Union. Now, the poll's given some interesting findings, with 63% believing Scotland shouldn't become independent and 18% thinking the country should go their separate ways. Meanwhile, 47% of people feel there will be no impact on their lives if a yes vote happened, and 28% don't care about the results of the referendum. Even with that 47% national figure, there's still questions locally about the impact a yes vote could have on cities such as Cambridge. Your thoughts?
Well, it's certainly going to make a big difference to Scottish people living in Cambridge, of whom there are plenty. They're going to have to decide which country they, in the event of a yes vote, which country they want to be citizens of. So that's a big result. But whether it's yes or no, I think there are going to be constitutional consequences one way or another which will affect potentially things here in Cambridge. There's been a lot of call for whether we should have an English Parliament, because if English MPs can't vote on what happens in Scotland under devolution, well, why should Scottish MPs vote on what happens in England, runs the argument.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because the Scottish Independent Referendum has actually spurred on calls for specific English parliaments or regional assemblies, perhaps one in here in East Anglia, where MPs could discuss English issues such as the rate of income tax, for example.
That's right. Scotland already has the right to vary the rate of income tax a little bit. Perhaps we could see that at regional level. It's hard to know. We've never really been here before. This is an extraordinary vote of a type that we just haven't got very much precedent for.
Do you think the three main Westminster leaders going up to Scotland has actually helped the No campaign, or do you think it has hindered it in a certain way?
Well, it has to be said that those three leaders at Westminster do not have the best popularity ratings that has ever been seen in politics, and you do have to wonder what impact they're separately having on the vote. But well, we'll find out soon enough. The polls are open in the morning tomorrow,
and it's quite interesting to see the re-emergence of Gordon Brown, for example.
Yes, he's clearly passionately involved in the campaign, and many people have spoken about his recent speech and contrasting that with his time as Prime Minister.
So the Yes campaign are saying that they want a free and fairer Scotland. Do you think that is the reason why a number of people in Scotland, nearly half the population, want there to be an independent country?
Well, there's really been a shift in the polls as the campaign has gone on. To start off with, it looked like it was going to be no by quite a comfortable margin. But now the latest polls are sort of 52-48, so it really is neck and neck, particularly given that the pollsters have never had one of these votes to try and take opinion polls on before.
And other sort of political figures have been in Scotland over the last couple of weeks. Most importantly, the leader of UKIP, Nigel Farage. What did you make of that?
Well, I think Nigel Farage certainly doesn't have as much support in Scotland as he does in other parts of the UK. So I don't know how he'll be viewing either possible outcome. We'll have to see what actually happens.
And there's been a lot of talking in the wings about a recall of Parliament, and a number of chief whips have apparently been finding out MPs' availabilities on Saturday. Do you think a recall of MPs to Westminster on Saturday following a yes or no vote is critical?
I think it will certainly happen if there's a yes vote, because we're just plunged into somewhat unexpected constitutional crisis.
Well, there's been calls for a recall of Parliament due to the events in Syria, for example, as well.
Yes, that's right. There's a lot going on in the world that MPs may need to be looking at. So they're due to be going to their various party conferences, which are scheduled fairly soon. And in fact, I think the Labour conference is the first one which would be most impacted by a recall.
And going back to the issues affecting us here in Cambridge, if a yes vote happened, do you think our university would suffer on the back of a yes vote?
It's maybe difficult to see directly what would happen. I think you would still get many Scottish people coming to Cambridge to study, even if Scotland were an independent country, because a lot of Cambridge students come from overseas at the moment. One of my favourite Cambridge statistics is 23% of Cambridge residents hold a non-UK passport. That would go up a bit with Scottish independence.
That was interesting, that. And obviously the polls open tomorrow morning. When people actually go and actually put their cross in the yes or no box, what do you think people will be thinking about when they're actually making the decision? What things do you think will be affecting them?
Well, who knows what's going through their minds in the privacy of the ballot box? And this is one reason why polling is so difficult, because maybe people are reluctant to give their true reasons for whether they're going to vote yes or no. But we have no precedent really to go on, so it's hard to say.
And it's interesting watching the television pictures of the coverage of the Scottish referendum. On one side, you've got the No campaigner saying that they're not sure what currency there would be if there was a yes vote, and the Yes campaigner saying they're just scaremongering. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think there are still a lot of questions on the issue of the currency. One option is clearly for Scotland just to carry on using the pound, even without the cooperation of London. There are some countries that use the US dollar like that. But again, we've never really had this sort of situation before. Applying for EU membership, theoretically at least, requires adoption of the euro, but Scotland's membership of the EU is another area that we just don't have all the answers on at the moment.
So I think it's an interesting one, and we'll only find out the results, because you said that the results will probably start coming about 3 o'clock on Friday morning.
That's right, yes, they're counting overnight, and some of the early results will come in a little bit before that. I expect there'll be exit polls, and most of the cities are declaring around 3 o'clock, but some of the larger cities, Glasgow and Edinburgh, I think are scheduled to come in at about 5-6 in the morning. And it could be very close.
And there's a current poll that's been released. Tell us about the figures for that, because it's very, very close, isn't it?
So there have been quite a few polls in the last few days. The majority have come out with around 52 to 48. But firstly, there's plus or minus 3 on those numbers. And secondly, people have never really had one of these elections to try and take opinion polls. There's a bit of a precedent in Quebec where the polls were kind of showing yes to win and in the end no won by a whisker. So maybe there's a bit of shy no going on. We'll have to see.
We'll have to wait and see. That's the Cambridge political blogger and ex-Lib Dem activist Phil Rogers. Thank you very much for joining me in the studio to talk about the Scottish referendum this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
From 10 till 1, mid-mornings with Mike Pryor. Cambridge 105.
I have two guests in the studio with me today, a lady called Anna Gilchrist, who's the project worker on something called the Dawn Project, and a colleague of hers called Kelly Brandt, who's actually the subject in many ways of the Dawn Project, I think, as well, aren't you? So good morning to you both.
Morning. Thanks for asking us in, Mike.
You're welcome. Now, you both work for and represent something called Cambridge Women's Resources Centre. So I guess the first thing to do is really to just give some sort of idea as to what exactly is that? What's it all about? What do you do and so on?
Okay, well, we're actually from the Dawn Project, which is based within the Cambridge Women's Resources Centre. The centre's a resource for women within the community. Been in the community for over 30 years, supporting women across all levels of life, really, education, self-development, encouraging women to change their lives and the lives of their families as well. So, yeah, we do a lot of really important work.
Now, I was looking on your website, and on there it says providing training, activities, and support to enable women of Cambridge and beyond to realise the potential in themselves, their families, and their communities. But we were talking before whilst the music was playing there, just about exactly the kind of people that use the facility there. And I don't think it's wrong to say that, on the whole, the kind of people that you come across are women who really need help to sort of pick themselves back off the ground again in many instances. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what kind of things do sort of women come with as issues that you try to help them with?
Well, to the centre itself, it can be anything from a difficult relationship, perhaps domestic violence, debt issues, lack of training, education, confidence, self-esteem. It's quite broad, you know, and so we will try and connect women with other services within the city and bring them into the centre to nurture them, really. It's a place for all women within the community to just have a bit of time to reassess, realign and move forward in their lives, really.
And what's the biggest problem that you find when you talk to these women? Because we were talking to Kelly earlier on. Kelly's going to give us some information about her own personal experiences and so on, but in general, I was suggesting to you that maybe one of the things that women have to recover from more than anything is to build back their self-esteem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, we were having quite an interesting conversation, weren't we? When your self-esteem goes, it's very difficult to get your head above the water, really, and to see any sort of hope or possibilities. And I think we are actually very focused on rebuilding people's lives, building their self-esteem, and helping people see there are possibilities and opportunities to be able to move forward, become independent again, be that financially or just within, to realise that other things are possible. Everybody has a different story, a different experience, and people respond in a different way.
So, Kelly, when you came across Anna, how did you come across Anna?
Well, I was sent there on 12 months probation. And I was there. It was drink related incidents, and I was sent there, and I didn't have any confidence at all. I was stuck in a rut. Just didn't think highly of myself at all. Just a bit lost, really.
Do you think you had lost your way in terms of what you wanted to do?
And yeah, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I mean, I was going through alcohol addiction. And I started getting help for that. It was just dealing with life, really.
And was it kind of getting on top of you?
Yeah, it was just dealing with day-to-day life without drinking, without picking a drink up. And I learned so much at the resource centre with the courses that were there, a lot about myself, a lot about why I did certain things. And so, yeah, I did learn a lot about myself. It took time, but I wouldn't have done it if it wouldn't have been for the resource centre. I don't believe that I'd be here where I am today if it wasn't for them, for the place.
Now, I was asking you whilst we were just talking earlier on and saying to you, you know, what did you find when you went there? And you were saying one of the biggest things that you found was that, you know, you mentioned about feeling very much on your own. But in fact, you found that there were lots and lots of people in similar situations.
Oh, yeah. I went there feeling that I was the only person that felt the way I did, very lonely and isolated. And then when I went there and spoke to other women that were there, I just realised that, you know, I wasn't on my own. And yeah, it's just a nice place, a safe place for women to open up and talk and share their experiences. And I think that's what we need.
And that gave you strength?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So talking about, you mentioned earlier on there, Anna, that you're both working on something called the Dawn Project. So tell us about that.
The Dawn Project's been based at the centre for about 5 years now. And it's a project that works within the criminal justice system. So we work with women who've gone through the courts or going through the criminal justice system, ex-offenders, and also vulnerable women in the community who are perhaps at risk of offending. So the purpose of the project is to identify what needs the women have, to work closely with them on those needs and to improve the quality of their lives. It's an amazing project. Dare I say it myself? It's quite astonishing.
So, in practical terms, what give me some examples of the kind of things that you do to help those women?
Okay, well, I mean, we may have women who perhaps have gone through the courts as a result of debts, for example, at risk of eviction, often with children who are within household. And so we will identify what the needs are, help them address the debt issues, give them a bit of structure, because there's often there's a lot of chaos in these women's lives. And I think once they come into an organisation that they realise that we are there to support them and guide them, not necessarily tell them what to do, it's guidance. It gives an opportunity to actually look at the issues. As an example, shoplifting. Perhaps some of the women that come through for shoplifting offences, it's actually quite a desperate need. They're on low incomes, and so we will look at other ways that they can become independent, and perhaps help them budget with budgeting, etc. So we're quite clear on the pathways we work on with women.
Mm. Yeah. And you know, I would guess that people in that sort of situation probably feel as though they've got nowhere to turn. So and as you mentioned a minute ago there, they perhaps come in and they're very agitated or very frantic and you know, their minds are all over the place perhaps. So just being able to, as Kelly was saying earlier on, be able to sit and talk to people and share experiences, does that have a calming effect, Kelly?
Definitely. Yeah, it does. And just the women that worked there, like when I first went, there was a bag of nerves. I thought I'd feel like this forever, just awful. But meeting the women like Anna and a few others, they do just encourage you, and I think that's what I needed, to be encouraged. And
how long ago roughly, Kelly, is it since you got involved with the organisation?
It would be 4 years this Christmas.
4 years, yeah. Right. And so how do you feel about yourself now compared to then?
Oh, totally different. Yeah. It's a bit of a blur, really, looking back, because I am a totally different person. Just what I'm doing now, the volunteering and stuff, it's...
Because that's the interesting thing. Both of you, in fact, you were saying that you both came in... I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but you both came in with a need, personally, of their services. But you've actually now become advocates, haven't you? You're actually volunteers working both for them, yeah?
Yeah.
So, and does Anna, tell me, is the need for those sorts of services and facilities and support for women, do you think it's the same as it's always been? Do you think it's getting worse, or how is it? Because obviously things like the recession that we've had for the last few years, you know, you mentioned there about budgeting and debt and so on, and clearly that must have had an effect, I would have thought.
Yeah, there's a very clear need. I mean, when I look at the Dawn Project also, it's about diverting women from custody as well, to have community sentences, so we're keeping families together, and also there's a financial saving for the government. But the needs for women are still very similar. Women still have education needs, so women in crisis. I think and it's very, very hard work what we do. It's not an easy punishment or option if you are going through the criminal justice system. It's about really looking in the mirror and confronting yourself. It's hard, hard work. But the need is increasing, I would say, with, you know, a recession, financial, economic difficulties that people are facing, fuel poverty, as an example. But I think with having the framework there for women to be able to access, as I say, it's not just about the women, it's about the family. Including the partners and the husbands, we're not excluding men from this at all. It's the fundamental family. And I think, you know, when we look at Kelly, what Kelly's managed to achieve is, well, it's inspiring, you know, and I've been lucky enough to mentor her through this process. And I feel very privileged to work alongside the women that I do.
It strikes me that the two main things that I'm picking up from talking to you is that, one, lots of women who come there, probably their self-esteem's low, and so they need to have that camaraderie and the ability to talk openly without fear of retribution or indeed, you know, anything of that nature to similar people in similar situations, and to build their confidence again. That sounds like one of the main things that's needed. But also, clearly, what you're saying there, Anna, is that they need to have good advice, you know, people who can say this is what you need to be doing and so on. So it's some of it's about community, I think, and some of it's about good advice from
absolutely.
Listening to.
Yeah, absolutely. And also it's a very non-judgmental community. I think, you know, women, particularly if they've been through the courts, they've perhaps been to prison or they're an ex-offender, there is a degree of real shame for women, real shame. And it, for us, it's very much about let's look how we can move forward positively rather than focus on the absolute negative. You know, and that's empowerment and raises self-esteem and confidence at the same time.
I mean, I've met loads of lovely women that go to the centre that have come, that are on probation. And they're all, you know, they're not bad people. They are just, like I've said before, stuck in a rut. And they just need guidance. They just need you to sit and listen to them. And, yeah, they are. I love the women that go
there. I mean, often what happens in life is that you get to a crossroads and you take one path and it leads you down one avenue in terms of a future and a fate and so on. And somebody else getting to the same crossroads would go a different way and they'd have a completely different outcome. And as Anna was saying, it's not necessarily that they're bad people. It's just that they've taken a direction which maybe they, you know, with hindsight, they perhaps wouldn't have done, really.
Absolutely,
you know.
Decision-making,
So, the Dawn Project, but also there's something called the No Offence CIC Redemption and Justice Awards. Now, Kelly... for her sins, Anna nominated you for this, didn't she, really?
Yeah.
So tell us all about that. What's that all about, then?
It's the... What's it called?
It's a national organisation that works within the criminal justice system. It's promoting positive innovation and change. And this award is actually to celebrate people who have made conscious decisions to change their lives. I nominated Kelly because I've been fortunate enough to share her journey and she is an inspiration.
And so basically the award is, I'm guessing, you tell me if I'm wrong here, but I'm guessing that the award is based on looking at Kelly's experience and circumstances and so on and judging, you know, the outcome of that, how things have gone for you, Kelly, since you first got in contact. How that's gone and whether that's been a good outcome. Is that the basis of the criteria that they judge
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kelly's, once she finished her order with us, she stayed with the centre and was volunteering and is now actually mentoring now with another organisation called SOVA, who work with offenders and ex-offenders. So she's actually in that role of supporting women who are travelling a similar journey to the one that she's travelled.
And you know, often I get people come in here and we talk to them and so on, and they're very understated and they don't wish to promote themselves. But reading the information that Anna sent through to me, Kelly, it seems that you're quite exceptional in terms of getting so far on with the... She'll be going red in a minute. You're quite exceptional in how far you've got on with this, because you've been shortlisted into... How many years are down to now, Anna?
Three.
Three?
She's in the final
This
three.
Is a national thing we're talking
national
about.
National thing. Yeah. We're going to an awards ceremony in October.
You see, she's gone very quiet now.
I mean, I think, you know, for me, nominating... And Kelly, I have observed the difficulties she's had to encounter through this journey and her commitment to change. And she's had to work very, very hard. It's not been an easy light option. It's not an easy process to go through by any means. And I think for young women, particularly if they are battling with alcohol addiction, for example, she really is a testament to working hard and making that commitment to change. So, yeah.
Mm.
She inspired
me. See, you've got all soft and coy now. Okay, so the awards, when do they occur then?
1st of October.
Right.
So the Dawn Project's actually in a category as well for innovation, so we'll be going down there to find out, you know, the outcome. But I think we're all, you know, we're winners.
So we've got everybody's winner
by the
sounds of
it. The top three. So it's fantastic.
So kind of, in terms of the awards, the worst that can happen is you come third, yeah?
Well, absolutely.
I'll be honest, I didn't think I'd, I don't know, I'm already a winner.
We
just
are.
Getting this
there
far,
it's
a complete shock.
You see, and, you know, the cliche is half full or half empty, right? You know, is the glass half full or is it half empty? And you've probably turned from thinking the glass was half empty to thinking it's half full now, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So obviously, obviously one of the things that no doubt people listening maybe would be interested is to if they are in a similar situation to people that we've been talking about there, how can you help them? How can they contact you? Where are you? How can you, what do they have to do to get assistance?
Okay. Well, we've got a rather nice new website, which is www.cwrc.org.uk. Go online and have a look at us. We also can be contacted by phone, or you can drop in. We're based in Hooper Street, which is just off Mill Road. And we're very open to drop-ins as well.
So, okay. Yeah. So just a couple of contact bits of information once again there. You said Hooper Street.
That's right.
And you've also mentioned the website. I'll mention it again, www.cwrc.org.uk. Uh-huh. And your telephone number?
01223 321 148.
Okay. And is there somebody there all the time?
We have someone there 9 till 4 and leave us a message if no one's answering the phone. Okay.
And do people have to have, there's lots of ways to contact there, but clearly they could just walk through the door as well. Mm. Do they need an appointment or can they just walk in?
If someone walks in, we will generally have a quick chat with them, depending on their need, either act immediately if it's an immediate need, or we'll make an appointment to do a more in-depth assessment of their need. So, yeah.
Well, girls, thanks ever so much for coming in. I hope people listening at home have found it useful, and certainly I found it very interesting. And once again, Kelly, congratulations.
Thank you.
In advance, whatever the outcome of the awards were, you're a winner, as you say. And that's
definitely
the great thing.
Thanks
ever so much.
Mid-mornings with Lee Chambers. Cambridge 105.
I've got Wayne Bent in front of me. Hello, Wayne.
Hello there.
And Wayne is chair of the Cambridgeshire Search and Rescue Team.
Well, standing chair at the moment, waiting for the AGM, yes.
And you will be regarded as heroes by very many people. Can you tell me a little bit about the work that you do?
Yeah, the work that Cambridgeshire Search and Rescue does is predominantly work that is behind the scenes that not many people in the county know we even exist. A lot of the work is done primarily for Cambridgeshire Constabulary in the search for missing vulnerable people. And that can be children right through to the elderly with numerous different reasons for why they've gone missing. And in Cambridgeshire alone, there's about 2,500 people every year that go missing, but only a very small percentage of those are classed as vulnerable. And that's the work that we do. So unsung heroes maybe, but we're just happy to be part of what we do.
Brilliant work. So what would a typical day comprise of for you then?
A typical day would be mainly going to work, and because what we actually do, this is an addition to our lives. This is a voluntary organisation. So everyone fits this in around their current busy lives. But in the event of a call out, it would be a phone call from the police explaining that there's someone missing vulnerable in the county, and a simple deployment via text message would be done by myself or one of the other search managers, and then the team would get together at a rendezvous point, and then the search would start for the missing person in conjunction with Cambridgeshire Constabulary. So
you're all volunteers, you come from all different walks of life.
Yes, very much so. Yes, we are a very varied bunch of people, and that variation actually gives us really good qualities, because most people in the team can actually bring something from their everyday skills that they do at work and offer that to the team. And then really for us, that's a free service, because we don't get any government funding or anything. Everything we do is shaking pots or doing the challenge like the guys are this weekend. So it's really important that our skill base is very varied.
You do have training to do this?
Yes, there's a lot of training. Once people actually show an interest in joining the team, there's an induction evening, which gives every potential trainee a really good insight into what the expectations are. And then there's about a three-month training programme with a full weekend course to actually qualify. And that's nationally accredited course that we run in Cambridgeshire. And then once that is complete and all that under your belt, it's a case of getting on with the team and learning the skills to be a search technician or go beyond that.
It's brilliant work, Wayne. And you're saying you don't get government funding. So the guys, what they're doing this weekend is to raise money for the project, for Cambridge Search and Rescue.
Yes, every penny that we raise this weekend will be going into the running of the team. And as you said, there is no government funding whatsoever. The team costs annually around £14,000 to £20,000 to run. So every penny of that is raised, and different events that we are around the county and different ideas like this, and you know, the guys who have thought of this event, good luck to them.
You'll tell us about this event. You, three of your team members, who are they?
The three team members are Gary, Dwayne and Lee, and they form three members of the kayak team that we actually use as a search technique and a search method for when we've got vulnerable people missing around water, so they can be easily deployed to do that. But they come up with this idea to think, oh, we'll raise some money, because Steve Tibbs, one of our other members, actually done Around the Wash Challenge last year, so the bar is being raised every year, and I'm just dreading my time, because 60 miles kayaking from Cambridge to Hunstanton is no mean feat.
So they're going along rivers and canals?
Yeah, they're actually leaving Cambridge, well, just at Fendidden, they're actually going to be leaving, and they're going to be going along the river all the way up past some locks and things, via Ely, down a market, and then they'll be going out onto the Wash at King's Lynn, and then hopefully coming in on the tide with at Hunstanton around lunchtime on Sunday.
And a kayak's like a canoe, is it?
Yeah, the guys are actually using sea kayaks. The difference between kayak and canoe, and this is something I've only recently learned, is that a kayak is something that you sit in, a canoe is something that you sit on as such. So the old Canadian canoes were very open. That's a canoe, and the guys are actually going to be using sea kayaks because they're a lot more efficient in the water, and for when they get out in the Wash, they'll actually need that, because there'll be quite a lot of swell and tidal stuff for them to deal with.
Yeah, either way, you're going to need an awful lot of upper arm strength, aren't you?
Yes, I mean, the guys have been training really hard. They've been the talk this week, because we've had our training sessions, has been about carb loading, and I feel like I've been carb loading with them for the last few years, really, in preparation.
Sacrifice,
Yeah, exactly. But no, they really have worked hard. They've been kayaking out most weekends recently, trying to get a good distance under their belts. And the sort of distances they're aiming at is about 10 miles in every 2 hours. So that's quite a feat. And the first day itself is actually around 46 miles that they're going to need to achieve. So let's hope they've got something left for the final 15 in the tidal parts for the Sunday.
I'm glad to hear they've approached it perhaps as you would expect in your line of work professionally. They've looked at proper training programs and nutrition.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of people, like I say, about the daily skills that you can bring to the team. And you know, we've got one of our ex-team members, Pat, who's a very proficient kayak instructor. He does some kayaking around Europe and Greece. So he's been training with the guys, and he'll actually be with them over the weekend as really their mentor, and making sure, keeping an eye on the safety. And then there's a few other people keeping an eye on the health and safety and the welfare of the team. So there's the three actually kayaking, but there's actually a big support team behind that as well.
Great. And they're doing 40 miles the first day.
Yeah, and then, around 46 miles on the first day. And then
the
14,
remainder...
Yeah, because on the Sunday it will be in the tidal areas of the Wash, and it's been a lot of work on tidal planning to make sure that they're going to be in the right place at the right time. And the weather's not looking favourable for them on the Sunday morning, but we'll wish them well and hope that all goes well.
And I hope you're going to tell me that on Saturday evening they'll be staying in a luxurious hotel, but I fear that you're
Yeah,
not
definitely.
Going to...
I mean, I really wanted them to go to a 5-star hotel, but unfortunately it's going to be camping by the river. And, you know, if they manage to cook something, that'll be good. But if Steve goes along, he usually carries a little cooker with him and bags of food, so they'll be having curry with custard probably, and they're the sort of things that they eat when
not
they're
together.
Out so
yeah
all really good quality stuff, but they've got a lot of energy drinks and things that really they'll need to actually replenish what they're using.
And people can track their progress, is that right?
Yes, we use a couple of systems within the mapping, and one is a local firm in Cambridge called View Ranger. It's a system that we use all the time, and we can actually track them via something called a buddy beacon. And in Ely on the day, we're hoping to have our ICU actually running View Ranger, so we can actually see the teams tracking from Cambridge all the way up through on the day. So people can go along at different points on the river to cheer them on or throw something at them.
And you've got a base in Cambridge where people can go and just learn more about Ely on Saturday, is that right? Where
that's
people can
right
go
yes
learn more
yeah
about
there's
your
the
week.
The green down by the river, which we're hoping to have a little bit of a fun day, so there'll be things there for children to come and have a look. while the children are playing the games and doing things, we can talk to the adults, hopefully raise a few pounds and also get a bit of awareness out there. And if any potential new team members like what they see and think, actually, yeah, I could do that, or I've got something to give, then we shall be happy to take their details and go from there.
Well, let's go through your contact details then. So if people are listening and they want to donate or support in any way, how can they do that?
Yeah, one of the best ways to actually get in touch with us is via the website, which is www.camsar.org, and that way most of the contact details that you need to actually join or show some interest fundraising are available via the website. But specifically for the kayak challenge, there is a text line that you can contact, and I'll give you those details now, which is CSAR14, that's all capital letters, then a pound sign with the amount of donation, which is hopefully nice and high, and then you text that to 70070, and then you should get the confirmation text back to say thank you very much for your donation, and then all of those donations go straight to the team.
And if anybody's, as you say, interested in becoming a volunteer for Cambridgeshire Search and Rescue, they can find out information either at your base by the river in Ely on yes. Saturday or on the website.
Yes, yeah, the website is the easiest way to do that, because on Saturday there will be people there, the membership secretary will be there, so take in direct details. But if you want to have a look at the website, learn a little bit more about the team, that's the place to do it, and then follow the appropriate tabs to find out about joining.
What are you doing tomorrow?
What am I doing? Well, I'm hopefully going down to Ely to actually cheer the guys on with the children, going to have a look at the fun day, and then I'm hoping for a nice drive up to the coast on Sunday. I should be sitting eating fish and chips on the front there with my children, and just watching the guys come in, and then hopefully join them, because we're being met with the Coast Guard. And the part of what Search and Rescue is, we're joining in as a national body, we're becoming Lowland Rescue, in line with Mountain Rescue, Cave Rescue and Coast Guard Rescue. So it'll be good to see the Coast Guard and coming to help with us. I hope we don't need to use them, but they're there for some moral support for us.
Well, good luck to you and your guys. Absolutely fascinating to hear about the work that you do, and do let us know how you get on.
All About the City. Cambridge 105.